nights and the ghettos play. Spitfire Breeze, the lives of women of color in Montreal. We come together to say no to the silencing of our voices.
Welcome to Spitfire Women of Color Radio, the 2013 holiday edition. Today we will look back at 2013 and play some of our most memorable pieces, stories, and interviews from the past year. We will remember the Birmingham bombing through the wisdom of Angela Davis, Renisha McBride and the Call for Justice, the story of blackface in Quebec, Jackie Wang on revolutionary loneliness. We will also bring you clips from some of our favorite interviews with honored guests Montreal journalist Nadia Dauphin, McGill professor and scholar Charmaine Nelson, jazz artist Malika Tirolien, and writer Faria Roy-Zen. Finally, we'll be sharing clips from some of our favorite discussion pieces by collective members old and new on topics from the controversial removal of Kwanzaa as proposed by Senator Glenn Grothman to one of 2013's arguably best films, Django Unchained. All that and more coming up on another holiday edition of Spitfire Radio on CKUT 90.3 FM.
Next clip, Alyssa brings you some of her memorable moments from 2013, from the umpteenth time she's had to remind us that slavery was in fact practiced in Canada, to Jackie Wang's revolutionary loneliness, to remembering the four little girls killed in the September 15, 1963 Birmingham bombing on the 16th Street Baptist Church in Birmingham, Alabama, to, of course, the memory of Renisha McBride. Sometimes the best way to parse haters hating is a brief wiki-supported history lesson. Let me give you some context. Nadia Dauphin's May 5th blog on Huffington Post Canada, entitled "Why the Hell Are Quebec Comedians Wearing Blackface?" was an astute commentary on the resurgence of blackface minstrelsy donned by white Quebec comedians that offered a moment to pause on the historical roots of blackface, namely the transatlantic slave trade that brought millions of enslaved Africans to the Americas for 3+ centuries. Instead of a constructive dialogue, however, the Post provoked a panicky denial by several journalists that Quebec was ever a place where A, slavery was practiced, or B, blackface minstrelsy was performed. To claim in 2013 that Quebec, or the rest of Canada for that matter, was never a destination for enslaved Africans is silly. If I think about it more seriously, however, I would say it is reckless, deceitful, and beneath anyone who cares about history and truth. If I were charitable, I could say that I don't blame the many, many people I have met in Canada who are ignorant of the practice of the slave trade by the French and the British. I, for one, learned about the Underground Railroad in elementary school and not about the enslaved Africans brought as bondage by French and British settlers. But it is 2013 after all. And I must say, in my more than 6 years on Spitfire, this is at least the fourth time our show has felt compelled to recount Canada's history of slavery. Today we hear from Jackie Wang. Jackie Wang is a writer currently based out of New Mexico. She writes about politics, literature, theory, and culture. She is currently working on a book about revolutionary loneliness for the Semiotext Intervention Series.
What role does loneliness play in the liberation narratives of militant women? And I expanded that to look at some trans warriors also. How does loneliness relate to the experience of gendered and racialized forms of violence? Which forms of suffering are considered political and which are considered banal, everyday, or insignificant? Why are certain forms of social suffering constructed as derivative, feminine, peripheral, personal, particular, and or unimportant? Which forms of social suffering are considered proper points of departure for revolutionary struggles and which are not? And do revolutionary struggles generate new types of loneliness and alienation? So this is actually the last question ended up being like the major component of this project that I'm working on. But what I was thinking about when I was kind of like outlining my questions that I wanted to guide this project is why is it like a political act to like say fight the cops or something and not to fight your rapist? That's been recast for some people, but I think there we consider who do we consider, actually let me phrase this as a question, who do we consider political prisoners? It's not like the women who are in prison for attacking their rapists and abusers. There's actually a very, very tight definition of who we consider a political prisoner. And so there is a way in which certain types of suffering or oppression do not register as political. And so this is like, it makes this whole question of, you know, what is like a political act more complicated than we might think, because I think it's highly gendered, it's highly racialized, and there are these implicit assumptions that we don't necessarily examine. Okay, I kind of started making a taxonomy in my head about types of social suffering or revolutionary loneliness. So there are different parts of the revolutionary experience that I'm interested in. Revolutionary trauma and PTSD. When we talk about like armed struggle and militant resistance, we don't necessarily think of like the trauma and the PTSD that often plagues people who participate in these movements. The pain of witnessing the murder, imprisonment, and exile of comrades, the psychological effects of incarceration, torture, and solitary confinement, the isolation that accompanies being betrayed by comrades, left melancholy and the despair that follows a failed revolution, the alienations that come with feeling like one's existence is unintelligible and one's labor and suffering is recognized by neither the larger society nor comrades. And this is something that, I don't know, maybe you've experienced where you get involved with something and you have this like hope, like this is going to be my new family, like these people are going to understand me and they're going to be, you know, they're going to want what I want, they're going to see what I do, they're going to recognize like the things that I've gone through. And then you get there and you're like, oh my gosh, I have to bracket this part of myself, like I feel like I have no outlet for this thing, like this meeting makes me crazy because like I don't operate on this wavelength, I don't communicate in this way. So all of those things are a part of political participation and can actually be produced in the process of struggling politically with people.
On September 15, 1963, a dynamite blast planted by the Ku Klux Klan killed four little girls in the church. Denise McNair was 11 years old. Carol Robertson, Cynthia Wesley, and Addie Mae Collins were all 14. 20 other people were injured. No one was arrested for the bombings for 14 years. We turn now to world-renowned author, activist, scholar Angela Davis, professor emerita at University of California, Santa Cruz.
In remembering and paying tribute to this tragic event, let us not pretend that we are simultaneously celebrating the end of racist violence and the triumph of democracy. Let us also not labor under the illusion that this church bombing was an anomaly. We know that Robert Chambliss, who was eventually convicted of carrying out the bombing, along with three others, we know that he had been responsible for bombing black homes and churches over so many years. As a matter of fact, during the 8 years prior to the church bombing, there had been 21 bombings in Birmingham. This man's nickname was Dynamite Bob. Bombings continued to plague black communities in Birmingham after September 15th. And everyone, including the FBI, knew who was behind them. What I fear is that many of the 50th anniversary observances, that many of them urge us to close the book on the racist violence of the civil rights era so that we can embalm that violence and transform it into something to be gazed at through the conventional lens of the museum. And so there is deep symbolism in the fact that these four young girls' lives were consumed by that bombing. It was children who were urging us to imagine a future that would be a future of equality and justice.
Renisha McBride is dead. Police telling us she took her last breath on this porch on Outer Drive in Dearborn Heights.
Southeastern Michigan is one of the most segregated areas in the country. That's a fact. It has been a fact for decades. It's a kind of apartheid where the city of Detroit is 80% plus black and is surrounded by very segregated suburbs. Dearborn Heights is what we call a sunset town. And it's basically, you know, towns that historically black people shouldn't be caught in after dark. It's something that was very common in the 50s and it continues to today.
So would you walk around that neighborhood at night?
I should be able to.
Renisha McBride! Renisha McBride! Renisha McBride!
Renisha could have easily been me. She had a life that was worth us gathering here today.
Every life in our community is valuable, whether you're in Detroit, whether you're in Dearborn, whether you're in Inkster, in particular as far as black life. The fact of the matter is, here's a person who was in an accident and she's trying to seek help. Gets a bullet in her head.
I'm sick and tired of seeing black women murdered, raped, beaten, shot, and nobody's talking about it. I'm sick of the apathy. I'm sick of the apathy in the community. I'm sick of the apathy in the media. And it's enough is enough. Where is this man? Who is he connected to?
That's
and
right.
Why don't we know who he is?
That's right.
Why is he not in there? If my son was 19 and shot somebody, he would be under that jail. This is wrong. This is wrong, and everybody needs to be out here complaining about it. This young woman is dead.
This is always wrong.
This is nothing new. This is nothing new. Dearborn is a city of restrictive covenants, right? This is a place that said, we prefer our own kind to live here, right? They've had to take that to the Supreme Court. This is fertile ground for the new apartheid.
Renisha McBride. Renisha McBride. Renisha McBride. Renisha McBride.
Welcome back to Spitfire Women of Color Radio, the 2013 Holiday Edition.
Maya's in the living room. She is angry. She is pulsing. She looks tough. The bruises of her anger apparent like swollen lumps on either sides of her cheeks. Yet, even through her own vexations, there is warmth, and it surges through her. She is a needy love. She is a confused love. The pain of unfulfillment travels fast through her blazing eyes. Every blink, every smile, every thousand-yard stare is a call to love. Alyssa, please don't wear that. Alyssa laughs at her. She's uncompromising to this woman, a stranger. Alyssa, please don't be rude, sweetheart. Oh, Mom, condescending. Oh, Mom, you're an idiot. Oh, Mom, what is wrong with you? Oh, Mom, I'm the best thing that ever happened to you. Oh, Mom, you're nothing without me. So much to say in such few little words. Alyssa, what's wrong, Mom? You're acting like a fucking cunt. I'm not there and there at the same time. I don't register. My facial expression remains intact, removed. I'm on Alyssa's side no matter what. Besides, what's a cunt anyway? I woke up and remembered that memory. It felt like a dream, lived, a past life. I couldn't remember how old I was, but I knew I was old enough to do something. Or at least to know that what Alyssa was doing was wrong. As I lay there not doing much of anything, I replayed it all in my mind. I tried to isolate the images of my mother that have formed in my brain. My mind focused on Alyssa, but I refocused it on Mama. She didn't do anything when Alyssa threw those words at her, assaulting the air, cutting through the energy like a slice of a guillotine running fast past towards gravity. She just stood. The liquid around her eyes rose, creating a film that sat there on the edge of the cliff, floating in the space between the lashes and her eyeball. I rewatched her every move in my mind, haunted by her composition, disturbed by her preciseness, and for the first time I realized that she was used to this. Her face didn't transform into a mask of pain, but there was a heartache etched all over. She bit her lips in a bid to pace the tears, and when Alyssa swiftly exited the room, laughing perniciously, my mother let the tears rain over her. I was there that day. I just sat as if I wasn't. It wasn't my fight. It wasn't my war. But I let my mother weep and mourn, already at loss for a child who had gone astray.
Yeah, so welcome to Spitfire, Bria.
Thank you for having me.
You're welcome. Why don't you tell us a bit about yourself and where you're coming from?
Oh, okay. Sure. Well, I just moved here from New York 4 months ago. I don't know. What do you want to know? Ask me questions. How do I introduce myself?
What were we just hearing? Like you.
Okay. I actually wanted to read more, but I felt like I was taking too much time. It's from my debut novel, Like a Bird. And it's about a girl, a woman of color, who is brutally raped and then disowned by her family.
Wow.
Yeah, and the story is of her basically... It starts off right at the beginning, the rape and then the being disowned, and then the whole novel pretty much focuses on her coming to terms with it and finding herself, essentially, through a very destructive moment. And the reason I started writing that was because at a very young age, I understood that there was something wrong with rape, but that there wasn't enough for women there wasn't a social platform to talk about it. And so I decided that I wanted to write a book in order to sort of give women room to talk about these destructive things that have happened to them. And I write, I mean, I've just actually maybe 2 weeks ago, I wrote an article for Huffington Post about Lindy West, this comedian who writes for Jezebel, and the backlash that she got after she said that people shouldn't make rape into comedy, like it shouldn't ever be a part of a comedy act. And I've my article was talking about how, you know, I had actually gone to a comedy show where that had happened, and then my friend afterwards was sort of took me to the side and said I was gang raped, and that was just like, you know, you never know because nobody talks about it, you know. So I don't. It's something that I am very passionate about, and that's what my novel is about.
Wow, that's super intense.
Yeah, it's really intense.
How long did it take you to do the sort of the research and the reflecting in order to, you know, engage with this topic?
Well, it's. One could say that it's never ending. Mm. I'm constantly, you know, aware of this because my mind is so attuned to sort of, you know, there's never enough information that you can find and never enough stories, you know.
Right.
One of the most beautiful things I've experienced is like women coming to me as a source of like comfort and being like, okay, I think that you will understand. Can I tell you my story? You know? And that sort of, you know, friends have done that. People, like complete strangers that I've met at parties, you know, just like openly telling me, you know, these like tragedies in their lives. They can't tell anybody else because nobody else will really listen. Families are so quick to sort of judge, especially I feel like, unfortunately, sort of the communities that maybe we come from, you know, our families are, you know, so much of, I mean, growing up for me, I was hypersexualized at a young age purely because of that's the way that my parents think. Everything is sort of overly sexual, you know?
Right.
And so it's a woman's fault, essentially. I mean, no, I would doubt that my parents would say that.
Don't tempt men.
Exactly. No, exactly.
By
you know?
Being born.
Don't, by yeah, like, my dad lives in Dubai, and whenever I go there, it's like, I have to, you know, it's just natural now, but, like, I can't wear certain things, because if a man looks at me, that's my fault, you know? So... it's interesting to sort of, yeah, see women come out, because everybody wants to talk about it. Nobody can, though.
Right.
Or not yet.
So, what's, like, the background of your main character?
Well, she's half Indian, half, just American. And that, the dichotomy of sort of having dual backgrounds is something that I relate to too. And so even just being a child of the West, but also child of like immigrant parents, you know, is a dichotomy that we all struggle with.
Third space.
Yeah, exactly. And so, that's something that I am like trying to delve into because it's taken me a while to sort of figure out that that sort of affects everything in my life.
Doesn't
you know,
it though?
I come from like I think that when you're young, you're sort of trying to figure out, why do I feel so strange? What is wrong? And then all of a sudden you're like, oh, fuck. Sorry. Am I allowed to say that? I'm just going to say that anyway.
It's happened. Let's move on.
Uh-oh.
I mean, you know, that this has affected every...
person of color who's grown up in the West.
Yes. Essentially, yeah.
Can you characterize it some more, just for our listeners? The strangeness.
Yeah, a feeling at loss in a way because you're never quite understood. You know, there's like this vagueness and this abstractness to you, and everybody kind of looks at you as if you are this thing, and it is an alienation because. I mean, personally, it really frustrates me when, and I know everybody has, like, their own little quirks that they that they hate. Stop myself. Okay. That they hate. You know, I personally, I hate it when people say, oh my God, I love your skin. Oh, your skin color is so...
Totally understandable. Because then it's like your differences are highlighted 10 times more than they need to be.
Yeah.
To make you feel like you're just on display 24-7.
24-7. Oh my God, your skin. Oh, what I wouldn't do to have your skin color. Oh my God.
Temporarily, of course.
Yeah. Well, that's the beauty of it. That's the beauty. They want the skin, but they don't want what comes with it.
Exactly.
That's the irony, I think. And that's something that I delve into on my podcast with my friend Ziba, which is called Two Brown Girls.
Yeah, let's hear more about that.
Publicize that.
Two Brown Girls.
Two Brown Girls. Follow us on Twitter or whatever.
Tumblr.com?
Yeah. I mean, just Google us.
You're there.
Doing well enough to be Googled. it's basically we are women of color and we talk about popular culture and film. Mm-hmm. We're both film critics, and so we like talking about Hollywood and the lack of people of color within Hollywood. And
can I just say deja vu moment right here on the show?
Because
that was like the topic of one of our shows, like last month, actually.
Yeah.
2 months ago.
For sure.
Yeah, you should have had me.
I know all too well it don't come easy. The chains of the world, they seem to move in tight. I try to walk around and was stumbling, so familiar. Try to get up, but the doubt is so strong. There's gotta be a wind in my bones. I'm looking for
You're tuned in to Spitfire Women of Color Radio on CKUT 90.3 FM. It is just about 6:30. For the next part of our show, we're turning to a news roundtable. Victoria?
Yeah, Django Unchained. The D is silent. Last month's release of Quentin Tarantino's latest film has sparked a tense debate that dates back to questions of the role of black representation, black art, and art that grapples with the horrors of transatlantic slavery. Some have accused Tarantino of luxuriating in violent imagery, while others maintain that the discomfort with the film indicates that our culture still has not yet dealt with the totality of slavery's impact. So today we've decided to have a roundtable on this amazing film, and I just want to also recognize all the awesome people in the studio today. So Malak, Mercedes, a guest, a friend of ours, a guest, Michelle, Yaz is here, hola. Alyssa, myself, Victoria. So yeah, we're just going to discuss and unpack some issues that I'd like to point out. The question of historical accuracy of the film, that's something that the news media was really talking about. The use of extreme language, violence, as well as the potential threat of this film inciting some kind of African-American rebellion,
they're going to start killing all the white people.
Anti-white bigotry, the role of the white director Quentin Tarantino, and also representations of femininity, like the female characters in the film. So there's lots to choose from. Maybe we can, just pick one.
Do you want to talk about which one specifically, Victoria?
Well, okay. Let's talk about violence first. That's a big one. Mm-hmm. There's lots of blood in the film. What do you guys think about that?
Well, I thought in terms of connecting violence to historical accuracy, I actually felt that in terms of the violence towards slaves in the movie was very accurate, with the whipping of Kerry Washington and the way that the slave traders were talking to the slaves, treating them. The movie opens with about seven slaves walking in iron chains, towards a next location.
And what it had done to their ankles.
Yeah, and I felt like that was very accurate, and I liked it because it made people very uncomfortable, but I feel that violence was incited, by humans against other humans. And right. I think it's very important for us to kind of stare in the face of like violent humanity and really accept that, because it did happen. I mean, so I feel in that sense it was.
For sure.
I think that I don't have a problem with the violence in the film at all. I will say that I watched an interview with Tarantino before the film was released in December, and he was talking about how when they initially screened the film as a test run, that it was much more graphic than it actually, the final cut turned out to be. For example, there's a scene of a slave of Leonardo DiCaprio's character who is getting ripped apart by dogs. Mm. And initially that scene was much more spot on, you know, the angles and the cuts that were used were much more, there was no way you could miss it. The way it's edited in the version that I think we all saw, I mean, you know what's happening and it's horrible and you can hear the dogs and you can hear the squeals, but you don't see it spot on. And a similar thing he said, he changed with the Mandingo fighting scene. Like the original one was actually much more graphic, and then he decided to take it back. But I mean, I guess I want to say also, and I really loved the film, so I just have to say I have a lot to say because I loved the film. But
Alyssa loved the film.
I loved the
just
film.
In case it wasn't.
Did you guys hear that I love the film? I really love the film. Hi, I love the film. Spoiler alert, the ending was amazing. But I guess it's just sort of how does a 2.5-hour film grapple with all of the violence of slavery? I just feel that this, because there's not enough films and not enough outlets where slavery is discussed, this film, and it's directed by someone who's not the descendant of a slave, so it's easy to put all of this stuff on this film and say, you didn't talk about this, you didn't represent this as accurately, but it's like maybe that's because our culture doesn't understand how this is, this violence is actually not that far removed from us.
But yeah, also in response to that, I just want to say, like, there are really two different kinds of violence and the pleasure or the pain of experiencing violence on the screen that's in the film. So because it's Quentin Tarantino, right? Like he does these revenge narratives where we all get to participate in the heroes or the heroines excessive use of violence to, you know, get a sense of justice and satisfaction. And often to the point of like kind of a very like, you know, very gory, you know, sort of tasteless sort of way of reveling in a parody of violence, right? So you have the parody of like
classic Tarantino,
exactly, of like putting a bunch of Nazis into a film auditorium and then burning the building down, which is what happened in Inglourious Basterds, where you have this, you know, Holocaust victim, you know, taking her revenge directly on Hitler, and you see all these people like trying to escape a burning building, right? That's violence, but it's in a different class of, say, like the historical representation of real lived, you know, pain and violence. So I think like with Tarantino, people can skewer the debate because which kind of violence are we really talking about?
Yeah.
Right? Because there are two different kinds that are going on there. It's his, like, the gratuitous, maybe the taking the pleasure of, like, you know, giving the power to Jamie Foxx to be, you know, the cowboy that gets to, that we will identify with, sort of like we can identify free reign with Clint Eastwood in his cowboy films, where we see him like taking down all of these bad guys, and we enjoy that kind of violence, and that violence isn't necessarily questioned, at least in mainstream circles. Here it is questioned because it's a revenge narrative of, you know, things that have happened that I think arguably, you know, culture hasn't really dealt with, right?
Yeah, that's a great point. Yeah, and I also feel that what you said about the multiple levels of violence really resonates with me. So for me, what was so interesting was not necessarily classic Tarantino shots of blood splattering really gruesomely when people are getting shot with rifles, but there's a scene early on in the film where Jamie Foxx's character gets hooked up with the bounty hunter who is essentially going to help him get back to his wife that is a slave of Leonardo DiCaprio. And they're just, something as benign seemingly as riding in on a horse in the middle of a town in a very Western looking motif, and seeing a shot where there's like a noose hanging from one of the rooftops, oh, and watching the shot of Jamie Foxx's head as he's riding on the horse going across the noose. It's not that it actually is going to come close to hanging him, but just this idea that
the visual
and the symbolism. I just felt like there were so many touches like that and so many points where I was like, oh, this is so interesting. Like, just as a visual, just visually, it was very interesting.
That's interesting. I actually completely missed that scene, so it's definitely a lot of subtleties going on.
So I'm going to be speaking to you guys about this ridiculous proposition that was put forth in the United States by a Senator Glenn Grothman about the removal of Kwanzaa as a holiday, which makes absolutely no sense to me. But anywho, so my story begins when I was channel surfing one day, and I came across an interesting debate on CNN. Now, normally I don't spend too much time watching CNN, but this was one occasion when it was a must. Although I did not hear the whole segment from its beginning, I heard enough to make me question the validity of what was being said. All I could think to myself was, is this for real? The discussion was between, as I said, Wisconsin Senator Glenn Grothman and host Ashley Banfield and Roland Martin concerning his commentary about Kwanzaa, the African-American holiday celebrated on December 26th until January 1st. Grothman was on CNN to clarify his grotesquely ignorant and insensitive comments, such as, quote, why are hardcore left-wingers still trying to talk about Kwanzaa, the supposed African-American holiday celebration between Christmas and New Year's Eve, well, New Year's Day? Or, why must we still hear about Kwanzaa? Kwanzaa is a holiday celebrated by left-wing nuts, because they don't like America and seek to destroy it.
Oh, no.
There's more. He also goes on to say almost all black people ignore Kwanzaa and how he is deeply troubled by the fact that schools are teaching the holiday. Although these are just snippets of his nonsensical rant, it seemed like being on CNN did nothing to clarify what he meant, but instead magnified the intolerance that America has towards other cultures that do not adhere to Western normative views of what constitutes an observed holiday. That is not to say that all of America thinks the way that Senator Grothman does, but when we have an individual in a position of power, so to speak, abusing said position, it makes me question the moral integrity of this person. When does it become acceptable to promote such cultural hatred on the basis of one's personal preference? Personally, if I could be face-to-face with Senator Grothman, I would say, who died and made you God? Where does he get
Amen.
Off? Where does he get off speaking for African Americans on whether or not they celebrate or care about Kwanzaa? Last time I checked, no one person could or should speak on behalf of a group of people, especially when they are not knowledgeable on the subject. Senator Grothman, in addition to your expertise on speaking political gibberish, are you also a telepath? That is my question to you. Please answer. How dare he be opposed to children learning about other people's traditions? Mm. I would think he would be supportive of the fact that the youth of today are becoming well-rounded individuals when it comes to the world around them, regardless of one's political views, race, creed, or background. How dare he propose Kwanzaa as a holiday dead set on dividing America when it promotes values such as unity, prosperity, family, which are coincidentally values that most Americans embrace? Well, I guess not all of them. Hint, hint. Interestingly enough, Senator Grothman could not defend himself when he came under scrutiny from both Martin and Banfield. Senator Grothman then enters into a coughing fit in an attempt to counter their arguments, to which the interview is then drawn to a conclusion. His persistence on trying to validate his ludicrous reasoning for removing Kwanzaa as a holiday makes me worry about the extent that blatant racism becomes mobilized through political means in order to further political gains. So I ask you, what are your general feelings on this situation, ladies?
Go, girl. That was well said. You should mail that to him.
A nice little letter.
Fantastic.
After the bow, I support Kwanzaa.
He needs to answer right now, is my
Facebook.
But doesn't it speak to this idea that somehow, because the president of the United States is a black man, and so is the first lady is a black woman, the kids are black, so now kind of racism is over, so therefore the need for Kwanzaa, which was to create a space among the holiday season for an African-American tradition that was unique, mm-hmm. is now not needed because we've overcome this barrier that, which I'm not saying I agree with that narrative at all, but doesn't do you, I'm just wondering if you think it like fits that general, you know, it's everything's finished. We won.
Definitely.
So now you're still trying to divide us, you know? Like you, Kwanzaa celebrators, you
hard, what do you call it? Quote, hardcore left wingers. I love that anyone that doesn't fit in with the capitalistic mainstream is automatically a hardcore left winger, whatever that means.
Mm-hmm. Well, obviously to him, it's like, as long as you're not Republican, you don't understand, like, I guess Christian values. Well, anything aside from that doesn't apply. So, like, for him, like, he has no argument, basically.
It's such horrible rhetoric, too, that CNN is basically legitimizing it by making it a debate, you know, not by
framing it
as completely ridiculous.
Well, I don't know. Well, it is ridiculous, but...
I mean, we have to question the validity of CNN in itself, because it's CNN, and... Yeah,
they can be reliable sometimes.
But this is the problem. It's like whether or not like you think or I think or we all think that CNN's coverage is not good or is not a representation of what we think is important. If it's consulted by a large audience as such, and then it's hosting this as if it's legitimate site of a debate, not asking the senator to resign, to apologize, to recant.
That's true.
You know, it really kind of reinforces how it's a legitimate question. Why do we still celebrate Kwanzaa? Mm-hmm. What's wrong with African Americans who do this? Why do they hate America? Like, it just feeds right. into this.
I mean, if Don Imus can come back and have a full career after the quote nappy-headed host comment, then it just shows you like how low the bar is for the American public and the like Western media to be shocked by something.
Definitely.
I don't know.
One more question for you guys. Well, I guess it's been kind of answered, but how do you think this kind of thinking will affect African Americans in the future? And do you think it could influence others to think the same way that Senator Grothman does? And I guess that goes back to what you said, Alyssa, about how it kind of just legitimizes it and there's no repercussions for it. Mm-hmm. But I just want to know what you guys think other than that.
Well, I think that, I mean, I don't personally celebrate Kwanzaa, but I still like it. I mean, it's not, and when I learned about it when I was a teenager, it was really cool. And it was like, oh, like, you know, people were really trying to address the fact that, you know, for Christmas for a lot of people, if you're not upper middle class and you don't have a house or a chimney or, you know, all of these things that come from like the Anglo-Saxon tradition of way of how the Anglo-Saxon kind of Protestant Christian ways of celebrating Christmas, it's not that you don't believe in the same things religiously, but it's just a different, you're coming from the cultural symbols from a different perspective. And I always liked the fact that Kwanzaa at least was an attempt to kind of create a space that wasn't existed. And I feel like this is always how in this era, the way things that were created in response to a lack of inclusion in the past get framed. So Kwanzaa becomes divisive, even though its whole purpose was to create a space. Mm-hmm. Affirmative action becomes like discrimination against other people, even though its whole intention was to make workplaces more open and inclusive. Mm-hmm. So it's this like constant, you know, disciplining of... And you know, hostility towards efforts that were made to address the fact that things were not universal, but they were treated as such. And I, you know, I don't know what the answer is, because it just seems that the rhetoric and you know, the access to the media for this kind of stuff is increasing. Like, that's my own personal opinion. I don't know. I don't have data or anything to back that up.
No, completely.
But
I feel like it reflects a really insidious form of oppression, too, because it's basically about assimilation. Assimilate, become like us. But assimilating to what exactly, and who gets to decide what's the basic standard that we're all assimilating to? And Alyssa's example of even a chimney is so... The cultural context of a chimney is so specific. And so it's assimilating to this very narrow, specific white culture. And that becomes incredibly, incredibly oppressive for anyone from a different culture.
Well, thank you, ladies.
Thank you, Mercedes. I think you should send that to the Mr. Senator man.
We'll all sign it.
Tonight.
I'll sign that.
Yeah.
I'm in. If you agree, say yes,
snippet from our August show where we had Nydia Dauphin and Professor Charmaine Nelson come in studio and discuss blackface and racism in Quebec.
We on this show have discussed the extreme reactions to open discussions of racism in Quebec. As a woman of color collective, our perspectives have been greatly influenced by the writing and courage of Nydia Dauphin. Her May 5th blog post on Huffington Post Canada, entitled "Why the Hell Are Quebec Comedians Wearing Blackface?", pointed out the resurgence of blackface donned by white Quebec comedians and offered a number of recent images demonstrating this trend. Her lucid commentary offered a moment to pause on the historical roots of blackface, the transatlantic slave trade that brought millions of enslaved Africans to the Americas for more than three centuries. Blackface minstrelsy was a popular, nostalgic site through which whites lamented the end of slavery, using dark, quote, humor, delivered in song, dance, and jokes that celebrated white fantasies of violence against black bodies. It is a disturbing reminder of slavery's evils and a symbol of anti-black racism. As Professor Nelson pointed out, the McCord Museum holds broadsheets, photography, advertisements, and other paraphernalia of Canadian minstrel troupes that performed in Canada in blackface in the 19th and 20th centuries. Nydia's plain and simple assertion that ugly forms of racism persist in Quebec society was mocked in many media outlets, as was Professor Nelson's response to the hostile reaction in the Montreal press. As a woman of color collective that comes together every month to say no to the silencing of the voices of women of color, to promote a platform for women of color to have self-determination, we are continuing the discussion today, and we are so thrilled to welcome Nydia to be with us in studio right here, right now.
Woo!
Woo! Welcome, Nydia.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
So let's start this off by telling us a little about yourself and your work.
Well, yeah, I was born and raised in Montreal, as I was previously mentioned. I am of Haitian origins, and contrary to what came out, I am really from Montreal. I did all my studies here from high school, Collège Notre-Dame, Cégep Brébeuf. I did my undergrad here at McGill and then did a master's at Université de Montréal. So I'm a Montrealer. So right now I work for an organization that advocates for a national food policy for all and for the right to food, the human right to food. And what drew me to this is really food justice. And food justice, in a simple way, it's looking at the food system through a critical race theory lens. And that's my passion.
Wonderful. So let's just jump into the nitty-gritty of why we are all here today. So, among the countless discussions and critiques about the growing use of blackface within Quebec entertainment, why do you think that it continues to be used despite its racist history?
I think that it shows us that there's still a lot of work to be done in Quebec when we're talking about race relations. The history is there. I mean, just to look at the reaction that I received from my article, and I had people telling us that, you know, there was no slavery in Quebec, that blackface did not originate in Quebec, therefore it was pretty much devoid of its racist baggage. I mean, it's just baffling to hear that in, 2013, and from educated people are not too familiar with these issues. So I think it's just a reminder that there's still a lot of work to be done. Of course, there's a good quality of life here in Montreal, but we still need to understand that we have a long way to go to make sure that everybody is respected, regardless of skin color, gender, sexual orientation, and such. It's just a reminder, I think.
Mm-hmm. So do you think, had a white Quebecois woman written a response like this, like what you had written, do you think that it would have received the same reaction from Quebec society?
I think there are a lot of things that went into play regarding the backlash that I received. And I think to answer that question, we need to realize that not a lot of people want to talk about race relations in Quebec. It's very uncomfortable and it's exhausting. And also we have to take into consideration the reality of Quebec society. We have a majority that is white, francophone, identify as Quebecer, that have suffered from oppression from white Anglophone Canadians. And that fact is pretty much tied in into their identity. So what happens is that there is not a lot of space allotted to people that do not identify to this group and that suffer oppression from this group to express and to state the oppression that they're victim of. And so I think that you know, that deters a lot of people from actually speaking out against racism. You see, like, victimization, or you become labeled as a victimologist, as bell hooks would say, both from people of color and non-people of color. And there's a shaming that happens where the person that is victim of the oppression or of racism is starting to be blamed. Like, mm-hmm. that, like, definitely happened to me in this event where I was called a racist and I was going bashing Quebec. And so I think when you put all these things in consideration and you still want to speak up, there are two ways that you can go about it, at least in my opinion. You could go, you know, the non-threatening way, holding people by the hand. This is what is going on, trying not to offend any people and not disturb the power dynamics. Or go the way I went about it, which was pretty matter of factly, like, this is wrong, this needs to stop. And you look at this, the way that I looked at the issue or decided to address it, and add to that the fact that I'm a woman of color that chose to express herself in English. I mean, mm-hmm. in my opinion, that's just a lethal combination. So I think all these things have to be taken in consideration when we're talking about the backlash that I received. I definitely ruffled some feathers, and I didn't go the non-too-disturbing way, and that didn't sit too well with people. I think I disturbed perhaps the power dynamics.
Mm-hmm. Lisa, would you like to weigh in on that question?
I actually have a follow-up question. I'm wondering, in the reactions that you received that were particularly vitriolic, if you found that there was a specific pattern or a clear thread with which people would rationalize what you were essentially trying to claim, which was that this is a trend. There is a resurgence of this and it's a pattern. Yeah. What was the most common way people either rationalized that? Was it just pretending like that wasn't true? Just outright denial? Was it, I know you are, but what am I? Kind of like turning it around?
Yeah, there are a lot of threads. I mean, one of the common ones was that I'm an outsider. That's why I stated where I went to school in the beginning, because somehow I became somebody from Toronto that had no idea what was going on in Quebec. I didn't know anything about the Quebec culture, where mm-hmm. Quebec is all that I know. I was born and raised here. And another thread, as I mentioned, is, yeah, this does not affect us at all. This is an American issue. We were trying to flatter the guy. I mean, and then also the comedian that was impersonated, you know, quote unquote, also came out saying that, no, you know, this is just this obsession by some people to trying to make white people feel guilty. So there was complete denial and just a twisting of reality that was just surreal, that there was no real desire to talk about this issue. It was totally defensive and not trying to engage in honest discussions about race relations in Quebec.
So this is Victoria Nam at Cafe Resonance, just prior to the new weekly performance of Calmunity Jazz Project, Sunday nights, every Sunday night, so everybody should come out and check it. I'm here with rising Montreal star, singer, songwriter, jazz, and hip-hop artist Malika Tirolien.
Hi, everybody. My name is Malika Tirolien.
Thank you so much for meeting with me. So, yeah, and like telling our listeners about your story as a musician here in Montreal. Can you first just give a brief introduction as to what your artistic practice is like right now?
I'm a singer, as you said, singer-songwriter. I'm doing jazz, soul, and some hip-hop sometimes. And I come from Guadeloupe. I studied in jazz in Montreal. And yes, I got a bachelor in music, in jazz music. And I've been in Montreal for several years now, so...
Tell me about how, like, your past, coming from Guadeloupe, like, how does that inform and influence, like, the music that you create right now?
It's more in my solo work, maybe, because I try to put a lot of my language in my songs. So I speak a lot of Creole in my songs. And I'm trying to put also the rhythm of my country into my music. So it's called Groka, it's like percussions, and I'm like doing a mix right now. I'm working on this on my project, on my my first album I'm working on right now. But I still try to sing more and more in Creole, even in Calmunity, I really like to write on positive things. I think that right now the world is really in a weird place, and we need positive, we need love. So I'm really trying to focus on that part and really spread as much light as I can with my the little love that I have, you know. So I'm writing about that, about love, about courage, about confidence, about revolution, about, you know, like just to make a change in this world so things get better. And I'm also really fighting for my brothers and sisters, because we're still struggling. Like, I'm still struggling as a black woman. It's still, there's still some inequities. So yeah, I'm fighting about that too, trying to put out to put it out in the world and make people realize that it's still there.
Awesome. Thanks so much. I have to ask you this last question. Who's your favorite rap artist, female rap artist out there in the world? Maybe she's not producing anymore, but just curious.
I'm going to have to say Lauryn Hill.
Awesome. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Welcome back to Spitfire Women of Color Radio, the 2013 Holiday Edition.
I don't want a lot for Christmas. There is just one thing I need. I don't care about the presents underneath the Christmas tree. I just want you for my own. Make my wish come true. All I want for Christmas is you.
There is just one thing I need, and I don't care about the listening to Spitfire Women of Color Radio, only on CKUT 90.3 FM. That brings us to the end of the show. We thank everyone who made this show possible, and we wish our listeners happy holidays and best wishes for the new year.